The ancients were aware of certain herbs by means of which a trance could be caused, or a suspension of the ordinary animation of the sensory perception. They made use of such herbs for sacred reasons. And there is considerable evidence that the use of wine in the early sacraments of both the pagans and the Christians was the result of the peculiar ecstasy which was produced by this stimulation. Thus, men have cherished, in one way or another, the concept that by some means, natural or artificial, the ordinary functions of the mind could be suspended, and that during these periods of suspension, man might receive a meaningful inner experience, and that this experience could have a beneficial effect upon his outer life, and for that matter, in the case of famous mystics, upon the lives of many other persons. Now, our concern this evening is primarily to study something of the machinery implied in this type of thinking. Unfortunately, there is a sufficient amount of general evidence so that we can proceed safely, at least a moderate distance, into our inquiry. Man, according to Plato, possessed two natures. One an essential nature, derived from God, and the other a material nature, derived from the earth, or from the physical elements of being. These two natures, combined within the human constitution, resulted in an entity which we call the soul. To the Greeks, the soul was a twofold creature. It was never regarded merely as one entity. They held it to be two contrary or striving natures, one continually striving to ascend into the presence of the ineffable, and the other continually striving to maintain the authority of matter over the life and consciousness of the individual. One part of the soul was considered to be objective and physically animate. This part, including the sensory perception, the emotions, and the lower mental nature, naturally verged toward the obvious and was more concerned with the perpetuation of its material state than in any further or abstract exercise. This part of the soul was sometimes referred to as the mortal soul or the animal soul. And it was usually regarded as being dominant in the uninitiated, unenlightened human being. Those who had not, by some striving within themselves, by some purification, or some cathartic discipline imposed upon their natures, had not risen in consciousness to the realization of the reality of the divine soul in themselves. Such persons were referred to as, by Plotinus, as beasts in the world of men. Now, this was not quite as insulting as it might first sound. It simply meant that these creatures lived an essentially animal existence, that animation to them was principally function, and that this function was concerned primarily with the survival of the corporeal state, with the advancement of corporeal concerns and considerations, the accumulation of worldly goods, the search for fame, honor, and distinction, and the highly competitive struggle for existence which now is regarded as the normal way of life. The Greeks were convinced that this so-called normalcy was really only an indication that most persons had not sought within themselves for a better way of life. The so-called normalcy was a product of comparative inertia, that the individual, not resisting any of the common pressures of life, but surrendering himself at all times to the most mortal of his interests and activities, simply lived in an objective state. He lived, whether asleep or awake, primarily in this world, of this world, under the hypnosis of the procedures and processes peculiar to this state of nature. This led Plato to regard nature itself with certain suspicion. He held that nature, in some way, sought to fasten itself upon the human soul, to keep man in bondage to the innumerable patterns and forms which surround him and which are made known to him through his sensory perception. But substantially, Buddha held the same position. He regarded the material state of man as a prison, as a place of limitation, or perhaps at best, a place of instruction. Man was here not merely to gratify or to fulfill the instincts of his mortal psychic part. He was here primarily to outgrow the limitation upon his own consciousness. He was here to increase in inward grace and perfection of spirit, and to elevate the mind above the concerns of this world to the concerns of the divine world, or of the universal nature to which he actually belonged, and of which he was actually a fragment or part. Under these conditions, it would be apparent that the objectification of the human faculty in the process of waking would have a tendency to hypnotize the person and bind him more and more to the concept of the reality of matter. As all of his interests centered here, as all of his activities were expressed here, it became only probable or reasonable that he should regard this world as the true abode of himself, that he should think of other worlds as distant or remote, and he should think of the invisible as unreal. He should think of things not easily understood as mysteries. He should regard that which was abstract as unfathomable. It was much easier for him to surround himself with mystery and remain more or less oriented in a mortal life than to hurl himself into the sea of mystery, there to come in contact with forces and circumstances about which he had little or no knowledge. Also, in the course of time, as the philosophers have pointed out, man has increased in mortal knowledge. He has gone further and further in his investigation of this material world. Yet his investigations have not been sufficiently rich in internal value to guarantee the maturity of his consciousness. He thus remains comparatively unconscious in a world of consciousness. He remains posited almost solely in a material state, in a world in which the material state is the lesser part. He has become so convinced that this lesser part is the all, the total, the completeness, that he regards anything beyond this lesser part as highly theoretical, speculative, and uncertain. The only solution to this problem, of course, lies in the reorientation of man himself. His only hope of escaping from this peculiar illusion into which he has fallen is that he shall develop such faculties and powers as will enable him to recognize the reality of things now held to be distant and mysterious. If man actually can orient himself onto a higher level of function, it is natural that this function, this higher level, will then become real, and that which he has left behind will slowly fade away as unreality. Reality is always the focal point of awareness. Reality is always where we are now, what we are now, and those things now perceived or considered. Thus it is essential to our growth that we experience a new kind of now on a higher level of function and understanding. Yet Plato also pointed out, as did the Egyptians and many other ancient peoples, that the so-called divine soul, or the higher part of man's psychic life, though not generally much considered, or involved in his mortal actions, nevertheless had an existence, had a continuing reality in itself, and was not destroyed or dissipated by the failure of the objective nature to understand or comprehend its meaning. The soul, in its higher sense, was as all superior things must be, greater, wiser, and better than those faculties and functions which are beneath it, and which are dependent upon it for their energy and their life. Thus the immortal soul is nobler than the mortal soul, and that part of man's consciousness which contemplates the eternal is superior to that part which can contemplate only temporal things. It is also essential to man that in some mysterious way his inner spiritual soul should have a means of communication with the objective life. This means of communication would naturally be incomplete or imperfect while it was not cultivated or disciplined. Yet it remained present, an available help in time of trouble. That part of man's consciousness which comes into function when all other functions fail, or when the problems confronting the individual are not to be solved by any of his ordinary faculties. One of the most simple examples of man's effort to reach into himself, into this higher psychic nature, this higher psychic reality, is the problem of prayer. Prayer becomes, in most cases, where it is genuine, a statement of necessity. It is sincerely spoken or a thought only when man is in his extremity. It is something to be turned to when other things have failed. It is our hope of justice where otherwise justice is not reasonably to be expected. It is our hope of help when all physical healing has been ineffective. It is our hope of understanding when we find the wisdom of this world insufficient to our needs. And thus man turns for spiritual consolation to some mysterious root within himself, making use of faculties and powers which are only occasionally called upon in his so-called everyday existence. The very circumstance of prayer bears witness to a law operating in life. The prayerful mood is nearly always one of humility. It is also one of spiritual expectancy. The individual really hopes and believes that his prayer will be given consideration. In order to be truly prayerful, Jesus told his disciples that they should enter into a closet and pray to their Father in secret, and that the Father who heard them in secret would reward them openly. This idea of entering into the closet or the quiet place seemed definitely to imply that man must have a worshipful attitude, a worshipful mood, if he is to expect to receive any guidance from the invisible sources of life. This relaxed expectancy, this quietude, this sense of reverence with which man enters into communion with the divine, these qualities are all of them calculated to reduce the tensions which are indicative of the so-called animal or mortal soul. Thus the individual achieves communion with the interior part of himself by attaining quietude, by reducing the pressures of his desires, by reducing the determinations of his will. For prayer is the process of permitting the divine to have its way in man. It means that man must relax away from his own purposes and from those values which under normal circumstances are dominant in his life. He must be prepared to sacrifice that which is perhaps most difficult for him to renounce, and that is self-will, self-determinism, and to place himself utterly in the keeping of universal principles. Naturally, a prayer of this kind, often accompanied by a ritual appropriate to it, or by periods of purification and fasting, or by various other rites and ceremonies, these processes have a tendency to bring about a condition of semi-sleep, if we understand the full implication of the term to sleep. Sleeping is actually the ceasing of our objective awareness. If we voluntarily sacrifice self-purpose, we achieve a kind of unpurposed state, which is similar to sleep. If we voluntarily sacrifice the testimony of our sensory perception, to trust rather upon the power of internal guidance, we also remove energy from these perceptions, reducing them, quieting them, calming them, and causing them to lose dominion over our conduct. Thus, while it is true that in sleep we achieve this relaxation, it is also true that in meditation or contemplation or in the higher disciplines of yoga or Vedanta, we also have this kind of detachment, this separation from things which have been pressing and urgent, this slipping away from the authority of the material world to govern our every reflex and instinct. Thus we may achieve a kind of waking sleep, a quietude, in which the consciousness gains also certain means of communication. I think perhaps the Taoists have as good a simile for this as almost any other religious group. Man must create a kind of capacity. He must transform his lower nature into a receiving vessel, into which the waters of life can be poured. And in order that this vessel may receive these waters, it must be emptied of its previous contents, whatever this content may have been. We cannot pour more water into a full vessel. We cannot bring more enlightenment to a self-opinionated person. We cannot take the worldly wise man who is certain of his own ideas and impose upon those ideas the will of heaven. Man must first of all empty himself of false knowledge. He must relax himself away from those opinions and attitudes and beliefs and convictions which have long held him prisoner, and which, many of them, are responsible for the emergency in which he finds himself. Thus he attains a kind of emptiness. He attains what Burney calls the great thirst, the desire for that which is real, the tremendous instinct to partake of the food of life rather than of the food of death. Thus, in quietude, we do have the individual entering into a voluntary state of peace, a state which is perhaps very similar to that of sleep. In sleep, the loss of consciousness is complete. In the state of peace, the loss of self-consciousness is complete. The individual does not cease to be aware, but he ceases to be obsessed or possessed by the products of his own awareness processes. This having been attained, the person finds himself receptive to the benediction of the internal. Plato tells us that under such conditions, the inner life of man may come through into his outer awareness, may impose itself symbolically or in some way upon his outward nature, delivering through man himself those oracles, messages, and important revelations which are necessary to the essential growth of man. Plato, Pythagoras, and many others affirm very clearly that the highest instruction that man can receive must come from within himself, that this instruction arises in his own consciousness as the gift of the divine within his own nature. Therefore, that man is most instructed when self-instructed, that is, receiving instruction from his own over-self, as Emerson might have called it. All the point we wish to particularly make is that there is this condition of imposed silence, of carefully calculated relaxation by which many wonderful mysteries can be attained in consciousness. The Greeks, the Egyptians, and the Hindus also carried the matter beyond this point. So they not only achieved relaxation, but they imposed certain specific disciplines or exercises. And these exercises, in many of the instances recorded, transcended the mere quieting of the personal consciousness, and as in the Buddhist discipline, achieved a complete suspension of objectivity. In this suspension of objectivity, the meditating person lost not only his external awareness of places and objects, but his own external awareness of self-existence. He became suspended in a state in which his own awareness was not much more apparent than in the case of sleep. He managed to become a being meditating without the realization or acceptance of selfhood. He was merely life in life. He was consciousness in consciousness. His own pleasures and purposes and desires had ceased even to be of interest to him. He remained in a kind of suspension, a suspension in which he felt or experienced or knew the immediacy and imminence of the eternal. And as in the case of the great later Indian saint, Sri Ramakrishna, he passed from his meditational condition into a kind of ecstasy, into a trance-like or coma-like state, not produced now by the ordinary processes of sleep, or by the extraordinary processes of drugs, but rather by the actual use of his own internal faculties, faculties which he had so trained that they were able to sustain their own continuity of internal consciousness, and that this internal consciousness was not in any way related to self-consciousness as we know it. This, in turn, has become the great problem of many scholars in relationship to Buddha's concept of the nirvana, which to the Westerner means extinction, but which more correctly to the Easterner means suspension. It means only the extinction of that which is not so. It means only man's recognition of the unreality of the material or illusionary state of being. Now, all this has a bearing upon our principal theme, inasmuch as it indicates some of the processes which ancient mystics have used to invoke transcendent experiences. Another very common type of process was that of fasting or extreme asceticism. Fasting is a process of reducing the power of the body over the soul. Now, we have many attitudes on this, and most modern persons regard such ancient disciplines as fasting for religious purposes as archaic, or belonging to another time, or laden with superstition or extraordinary fanaticism. But the principle behind fasting has been known since the dawn of time and has been practiced by nearly all primitive people long before they had any theology or philosophy such as we know. The experience of fasting with them led to one inevitable conclusion, namely that as the power of the body or the bodily energy was depleted, the individual became more sensitive to superphysical experiences. The person fasting had cleansed the body of its principal toxins, and toxins, of course, are one of the causes of psychic tension and irritation. The person, therefore, who had reduced the body awareness with which we are so much concerned, also had reduced the body complaint, which is constantly and insidiously encroaching upon our consciousness, and reduced the bodily incentive, the vitalities by means of which we are impelled to various successes of actions. The reduction of all these left the person, perhaps, weak. Perhaps in this weakness also, drowsy, uncertain of his own objectivity. It was easier for him to sleep in this state, and he found that his sleeping had a certain clarity which was not common where the body was laden with a mass of physical impurity. Thus, purification and fasting, because of their effect upon the endocrine system, or the ductless gland chain of the human body, seem to lead more directly and immediately to a condition of complete receptivity to the overself. Thus, ancient primitive people went out into the wilderness, and there they fasted and prayed, meditated and waited. And in this time of quiet, watchful waiting, they achieved a rapport with life that is almost entirely unknown to us. We watch for very little that is not within the gamut of our sensory perception. We wait for almost nothing. Our lives are dedicated to expediency, the immediate actions, whether they are well considered or not. As a result of this haste, of this continual externalizing of our every resource, we do not have either the time nor the inclination to become especially subjective, or to search within ourselves for hidden and subtle forces that will not appear or manifest their own natures while man obscures them with the pressure of his physical interests and activities. So we know also that under certain stress or strain of a psychological nature, man may be disturbed by dreams. The dreams, therefore, constitute a kind of symbolism. We know that by means of the dream process, certain essential psychological verities may be revealed. That in his dream symbolism, the individual may receive a clearer insight into his own composition. He may become more acutely aware of the causes of his own psychoneurotic tension. In dreams, therefore, he receives the direct impact of pressures or forces or disturbances which come to him in his conscious state, physically conscious state, only as obscure impulses or difficult instincts with which he has to struggle throughout the day. Thus in sleep we do know that a certain therapy is applied, that it is quite possible that in sleep things confused or obscured become clarified. We also know that in sleep, the subconscious or subjective part of man is more available to influence than in his waking state. We also know that in the hypnotic state, which is that of an artificially induced state, the individual is able to be influenced far beyond that which is possible under his normal objective condition. Thus, the door that leads into the world of sleep leads into many mysteries, leads into strange byways and paths about which we know comparatively little and which under normal conditions may cause us fear or anxiety. Back to our original consideration, visions are unquestionably types of psychical experiences derived principally from within ourselves. Now there may be instances in which this is not essentially true. But a vision, for the most part, is a valid kind of dream. It is a dream of meaning. It is a dream of purpose, a dream of communication between the inner and the outer life of the individual. It is a dream usually in which some larger value, perhaps of a highly spiritual nature, of a reality beyond our easy estimation, is suddenly projected upon us by means available, when by reason or argument, no such impression could be made. The dream has peculiar validity as vision or as mystical experience because it is so totally our own. A dream can give us a sense of inevitable. It makes something which would otherwise be impossible or incredible, both acceptable and useful. If, for example, we can imagine what may well have occurred in the debate between Paul of Tarsus and the early Christian community, we know that Saul, or Paul, was a sincere man, that he was convinced that the Christian heresy had to be stamped out. Also, however, Paul was a thoughtful person, a regular and devout member of his own congregation. He believed sincerely in the importance of religion in the life of man. He did not, however, agree with or believe the religion of the Christians. There is no doubt that he was subjected to some pressure in this direction. It was quite possible that efforts had been made to convert him, but he resisted stoutly on the ground of his own basic religious principles. It would have been comparatively impossible to have argued Paul into a state of Christian acceptance. It is doubtful if any scholar could have achieved it. It is doubtful if any amount of reading or study would have converted him, for the reason that he felt that his own spiritual interior was right, that what he was doing had the sanction of his God, that he was correct in his own interpretation of this matter. And from his later conduct, we realize that his correctness was not simply a matter of ego. It was not that he felt that he believed that he knew more than other people. He was simply a devout member of his faith, and he believed his faith. He held it to be sacred. Yet somewhere in his early contact with Christianity, something must have moved Paul profoundly. That which consciously he could not accept or did not accept must have awakened some form of subconscious realization in his own nature. Therefore, Paul truly, perhaps, had that double soul reaction. The higher soul, which probably verged toward Christianity, and the lower or human rational soul, which perhaps is what he meant when he referred to the thorn in his flesh. On the road to Damascus, the theophany, or the mystical experience of Paul, becomes therefore a tremendous internal release. It was the power of something locked in him over the power of his own believing. His inner life had in some way been touched, moved, or affected by the message of the Galileans. And his resistance to this inner impulse was a resistance of patriotism, a resistance born out of religious duty, the same that many of us feel when we do not wish to be led out of the faiths of our childhood into some religion or belief that is strange and unknown to us. We feel a certain sense of loyalty to the God we have worshipped in the past, and it is not easy always to change that loyalty or to permit it to grow or to enlarge its own value. We believe that our orthodoxy is our virtue. Therefore, we try to cling to that virtue. In the case of Paul, the inner life certainly burst through. It is described in the older apocryphal writings, at least, that he was riding upon a horse on the way to Damascus to persecute the Christian community there. He had already attacked one of his disciples and injured him in physical combat. And Paul was very close to a situation in which a great war of values was being fought within his own psychic nature. Then came what is described as this flash of light, this tremendous burst of radiance. Paul fell stunned from his horse to the ground and lay there temporarily blinded. In the midst of this tremendous psychic stress, which some have even gone so far as to say represented a convulsion or some kind of an apoplectic stroke, but in any event, whatever it was, in the midst of this, Paul had the experience of the theophany. In one account, it is implied that he actually saw Jesus, or appeared to see him, and that Jesus spoke to him. In another account, in the same Bible, Paul apparently did not claim to have seen anyone, but a great light, and a voice speaking out of the light. And this voice undoubtedly spoke the very word that Paul's own soul was crying out to utter. Paul was not by nature a persecuting man. It must have been a very difficult thing for him to have felt that his religion required that he persecute someone else. Once his clear concept was attained, he not only never persecuted again, but also permitted himself to be persecuted to martyrdom. Therefore, he was not by nature an evil man who wanted to hurt people. And it is quite possible that the final revulsion came as a result of his own older religion seeming to demand violence of him, a violence against the faith of other good people, something which Paul rebelled against inside, even though he could not put his rebellion into the terms of his conscious mind. In any event, this experience was a breaking through, undoubtedly, of something locked within Paul. It was a breaking through under an extraordinary pressure. Now, there are several possible explanations for the pressure itself. Some have suggested that in light of the region and the condition, a sunstroke or heat prostration might well have been a contributing cause. It might also well be that as he was on his way to the final act of persecution, that the conflict within himself became unendurable. Here there came a tremendous psychic revulsion. And this revulsion took the form of the simple question that he probably asked himself. Why did he persecute these people? And this problem as to why he should persecute came through in all its force. And from that time on, Paul persecuted no more. He was still blind, as he said, when he reached Damascus. And his sight was restored to him by one of the elders of the Christian community there. Here we should have a very interesting and almost complete problem for modern psychoanalysis, a problem which would not reflect adversely upon the character of Paul, would not make him appear to be an evil man, suddenly transmuted into a good man by a mere act of providence. This act of providence was Paul himself. And this is indicated by his ministry from that point on. This ministry could not have arisen in a man of lacking great courage of character, great dedication to principle, and a profound respect for truth in all of its aspects. But in this theophany, we have the struggle of a highly enlightened, highly sensitive person, and the sudden revulsion within himself, accompanied by violent symptoms. Thus we see that a vision can be, and probably often is, the statement of a reality inwardly held, but not externally accepted. Man may well be better inside than he is on the outside. He may well know more, because as we go into the interior parts of man, we also enter into the superior aspects of his consciousness. Whatever is the best of man is locked at the core of his being. And as man reaches further and further in toward that core, he becomes aware of greater and greater value and is therefore more impelled to the conduct of his nature in a commendable way. We do not know whether Paul was able to rationalize these problems, although it is implied that he was a student of Platonic philosophy. But in any event, it would be quite reasonable to assume that a struggle had occurred between the mortal soul with its material dedication to form and tradition, and the immortal soul, the divine part, that recognized no dedication except to that of the highest principle that could be known and estimated by that being. Now, it is quite true that many such visions have been reported, and that these visions lie at the basis of the canonization of a great many of the early saints of the Church. Visions of this kind are still reported, not only in Christianity, but among nearly all people, perhaps very strongly among the Muslims and Buddhists. These visions, nearly always, are visions implying or suggesting a nobler condition, a state beyond that which is ordinarily acceptable. And they bestow the strength for a voluntary allegiance to a greater and better cause, or to a fuller expression of some great spiritual reality. Under such conditions, we are also aware that the vision may occur in condition or time not normally associated with sleep. But as in the case of St. Paul, we find that the actual occurrence was preceded by a shock or some mysterious force that cast the future apostle into a state of confusion and comparative unconsciousness. In other words, whatever the original element of the pattern was, the theophany was preceded by something that blinded him, a light that burst upon his consciousness and hurled him to the ground, a kind of power that paralyzed him completely and made it impossible for him to maintain any objective mental integration. He was simply thrown into a complete internal confusion. And in the midst of this suspension of all his worldliness, the core or significant part of the vision transmission took place. He then gradually gathered his faculties about him and proceeded on to Damascus. But in a crippled and miserable state, greatly fearful, uncertain, and in the mood of despising himself. It was only after the full impact of the circumstance began to be recognized and realized that it led to the dedication which gave the world the extraordinary ministry and service of the Apostle Paul. Now, we do not necessarily assume that everyone has so vital or startling an example of this peculiar psychic process. But we do know that nearly everyone has an availability, a means of reaching into self, if this means is called upon, or if an emergency or urgency should demand or require it. There are innumerable cases of visions of varying degrees which have led to a powerful changes in the life of the person, and also powerful ministry to others in various religious, philosophical, and even scientific fields. The vision is not unknown to science. It is not unknown to scientists, although because of the peculiar intellectual orientation which they have, it is not as common with them as it is with persons of a more simple and devout mentality. Simplicity is another point in which nature seems to be profoundly concerned. And most of your mystics, particularly those of Asia and the earlier Christian mystics, actually cultivated a kind of simplicity of nature and life and of thought. They were seldom to be considered as sophisticated persons. Many of them were not scholars as we understand scholarship. They were more considered as pious people, living simply in an almost continuous state of prayer or of strong, continuing faith, and therefore almost constantly, psychically relaxed. Under such conditions, the availability of the mystical experience is greater than with most ordinary folks. Plotinus, the great Neoplatonist, describes in substance two or three visions which occurred to him during his lifetime. Plotinus was a philosopher. He was an intellectual. He was a man of powerful mind and most penetrating genius. He was one of the outstanding leaders of the world of thought of his time. Yet Plotinus was not an intellectual as we would judge them today. He was not a sophisticate. He was not a worldly man. He was not a seeker after knowledge for the sake of knowledge. He was primarily a mystic. And Neoplatonism, which derives so much from him, is considered today as a mystical rather than an essentially philosophical doctrine. Plotinus described mystical experiences which occurred, which lasted only a brief time, and which were very rare of happening, but which profoundly affected his life in those moments in which it seemed that he was lifted up and brought into identity with reality. He had then a peculiar sense of belongingness. He was one with space. He was one with life and eternity and time. He found his true relationship to existence, a relationship of identity, a relationship of profound sympathy, a relationship which brought both tears and laughter to his soul. the relationship in which the universality of the good became not realized or believed, but perfectly and fully known by a total conscious experience of fact. These experiences of Plotinus certainly must be included among the great historical mystical occurrences. We know also that Plotinus at his school cultivated metaphysical discipline, that they practiced concentration and meditation much in the spirit of the Pythagoreans, that they set aside parts of the day and of life for the quiet contemplation of the will of God. And while they approached the mysteries of the universe intellectually, they tried to think with the mind of God. They tried to understand with the understanding of God. Thus they were pious, devout persons, even though they were brilliant scholars. This combination is not so common in these days, where scholarship and piety are further apart than ever before in history. Yet it is the bringing together of these two that seems to make possible more direct internal leadership, more participation in the mysteries of heaven. We know, of course, that most of the book of John known as the Apocalypse, or the revelation of John on the island of Patmos, that this entire book is written as a dream, or as a mystical experience. John did not know whether he was in the flesh or not. He was simply separated from worldliness. And in this separation, the story, the vision of the Apocalypse was unfolded to him. Here again is a mystical revelation arising from previous personal experiences, from previous knowledge and indoctrination, from the religious community in which he dwelt, for while on the island of Patmos, he was close to some of the greatest centers of ancient pre-Christian mysticism. We have here many factors, perhaps revealing much of the background of John that would not be recorded by the gospel historians. The story of the inner life of the man, which finally blazed out in the vision of the Apocalypse. Thus, these visions do have some valid core relating to our own peculiar problems and our own peculiar needs. Yet they do not end there. They end with a kind of clarification. The problem becomes ensouled by a power greater than itself, and by this very process ceases to be a problem. A problem exists only when man is less than the problem. When he becomes greater than the problem is absorbed into his own greatness. And there is a tremendous spiritual exhilaration arising from this victory of the self over circumstance, or of the good man over providence. All these things then can be brought right back to our own daily lives and the situations in which we find ourselves. I think, although we are not aware of it under normal conditions, that we participate more in mystical experiences than we know. The mystical experience in a large and complete pattern is probably a stranger to most. But in a series of continuing interior impulses, I suspect that it is not entirely strange to the average person. We all have moments in which it appears that our knowledge or our understanding transcends itself. There are instances when our judgment is greater than we realize. There are seconds in which decisions are made that are better than we know. There are tremendous emergencies which we meet with a new courage or a profound sense of value which a few hours before would not have been available to us. Thus it would appear that the individual is subject to an insight due to a kind of disorientation. This type of disorientation arises when the individual suddenly finds himself inadequate. When we are suddenly aware that we have lost control of a situation, or lost control of ourselves, or that we face an unknown that is deeper than we can fathom, there is this moment of uncertainty. There is this moment of confusion. And in this instance, our self-assurance breaks down. In this instance, our self-sufficiency breaks down. And of course, most of all, we may be confronted by sudden evidence that our own thinking has been poor. That instead of being always right, as we thought we were, we are suddenly confronted by the proof that we are wrong. That something that was supposed to happen did not. Something we trusted would not happen occurred. And we are out of focus with our own previous concept. We have become involved in a mystery. A mystery in which our ordinary faculties are not adequate. In this moment of hesitation, in this moment of disorientation, there seems to be a temporary weakening of the objective faculties. We are a little discouraged at them. We are suddenly unsold upon them. We are no longer certain that they are what we have thought them to be. For a second, therefore, they lose their authority to dominate us. And in that moment in which the objective mind no longer has authority, the subjective mind comes through, taking over this situation and bestowing the remedy, or giving us some insight or clue as to that which can usefully solve our problem. It is also noted that while man dreams undoubtedly throughout most of the periods of sleep, significant dreams have the tendency to center in the early morning hours. In these hours, the individual is perhaps in a situation or condition more resembling trance than true sleep. In true sleep, we have an almost complete unconsciousness. The person rests in an oblivion of mind, and under normal conditions, has slight, if any, recollection in waking of anything that occurred during his sleeping hours. However, in the early morning hours, where visions are most frequent, especially those of an authoritative nature, man appears to be less asleep. He is almost in a light hypnosis, from which he could rather easily awaken. In fact, at the proper time in the morning, he usually awakens himself by habit in order to meet the requirements of the day. He sets his mind at 7 o'clock, he will awake at 7 o'clock. But by that time, the mind has begun again to exercise authority.